You know, I was sitting at breakfast this morning, just eating a piece of toast, drinking some coffee, scrolling on my phone, just existing. And it struck me how incredibly automatic it all feels. I don't have to, tell my stomach to digest. I don't have to remind my lungs to inflate. It just happens.
It is the ultimate luxury, isn't it? Being able to just ignore the machinery.
Exactly. But then I started thinking, if you actually pop the hood on the human body, it's not peaceful in there at all. It's like chaos. It's a million things happening at once.
See, I'd argue it's the opposite of chaos. It's engineering. It's a finely tuned, highly aggressive maintenance schedule.
And that is what we're digging into today. We're looking at the operating system of life.
Right. Not just human life, all life.
And to help us decode this, we're looking at a set of notes on life processes. Now, these are class notes designed by Shobhit Nirwan. And I have to say, for a set of student notes, these are remarkably dense.
They are. Shobhit does a great job of just stripping away the fluff. What I love about this source material is that it frames being alive not as a state of being, but as a job. It's work.
Right. And the notes break this job down into four big pillars. You've got nutrition, respiration, transportation, and excretion.
Which honestly sounds a bit like a city planning meeting.
It kind of does.
Okay.
But here's the mission for this deep dive.
About.
I want to understand how my toast triggers a chain reaction across all four of those pillars. Because honestly, I usually think of them as separate things.
Yeah.
Eating is one thing, breathing is another. Going to the bathroom is, well, a necessity.
But they are all one loop. You just can't have one without the others. And Shobhit's notes actually map this out beautifully. It all starts with the input problem. You're a machine that burns fuel. You need to get the fuel inside.
Which brings us to pillar one, nutrition. Now, in the notes, there's this immediate divide between two types of organisms, the autotrophs and the heterotrophs.
Right. Or, as I like to call them, the makers and the takers.
The makers being plants.
Exactly. Autotrophs. They don't need to go out and find a sandwich. They have the machinery to, build the sandwich from scratch using raw materials.
Photosynthesis. I remember the basic equation from school: sunlight, water, CO2.
It sounds simple, but think about the chemistry. They take carbon dioxide from the air and water from the soil. They use chlorophyll to trap sunlight energy, and they smash those ingredients together to form glucose carbohydrates.
And as a byproduct, they release oxygen, which is, pretty helpful for us.
Very helpful. But the notes mention something interesting about storage here. Plants don't burn all that cash at once.
No, they're savers.
They convert the extra glucose into starch and store it in their leaves and roots. It's their pantry for a rainy day. But there is a mechanical detail in the notes that I really want to highlight. You mentioned CO2. How does the plant actually get the gas inside the leaf?
Oh, there are those tiny holes, right? The stomata.
Correct. But here's the engineering challenge. A plant doesn't have muscles. It doesn't have a brain to say, open your mouth. So how does it open these pores?
The notes had a diagram of this. It showed these guard cells around the hole. But I wasn't entirely clear on the mechanism. It looked like they were swelling up.
That is exactly it. It's a hydraulic system.
A hydraulic system.
Yeah. When water flows into these guard cells, they swell up, they become turgid,
Wow.
and because of their shape, that swelling pulls the walls apart, physically forcing the pore open.
So it's like a water-powered automatic door.
Precisely. And when the plant needs to close the door, maybe it's losing too much water, the water flows out of the guard cells, they shrink or become flaccid, and the hole just snaps shut.
That is incredible. No electricity, no muscles, just water pressure. Okay, so that's the plants. They're set. But then there's us, the heterotrophs, the takers.
We can't make food. We have to steal it from the autotrophs or eat the animals that ate the autotrophs.
And once we eat it, we have to deal with the alimentary canal, which sounds like a horrible theme park ride, by the way.
It is a long, winding tube, that's for sure, from mouth to anus. But the magic happens at the stations along the way.
So let's trace that toast I ate this morning. I put it in my mouth, I chew it up. I assume the main goal here is just to smash it into small enough pieces to swallow.
See, that's the common misconception. We think the mouth is just a grinder. But Shobhit's notes point out that the chemical processing starts right there on your tongue.
Wait, really? I thought digestion happened in the stomach.
If you wait for the stomach, you're losing efficiency. Your saliva isn't just water to make things slippery, it contains an enzyme.
The notes mention salivary amylase.
That's the one. Amylase is a biological catalyst. So while your teeth are physically crushing that toast, the amylase is chemically attacking the starch molecules, breaking them down into simpler sugars like maltose.
So my spit is actually digesting my food.
It is. By the time you swallow, that toast is already chemically different than when you picked it up.
Okay, so down it goes. Through the esophagus, which the notes say moves in a wave-like motion called peristalsis, and into the stomach. Now, I always picture the stomach as just a bag of acid.
It is a bag, but churning bag is a better description. And yes, there is acid, hydrochloric acid or HCl.
That sounds dangerous. Why do we have industrial-grade acid inside us?
Two reasons. First, biology is messy. The food you eat isn't sterile. The acid kills off bacteria.
Okay.
But secondly, and more importantly, the stomach has another enzyme called pepsin that digests protein.
And let me guess, pepsin is picky.
Extremely. Pepsin refuses to work unless it's in an acidic environment, so the stomach pumps out HCl just to set the stage for the pepsin to do its job.
But hold on. If my stomach is full of acid strong enough to activate enzymes and kill bacteria, why doesn't it digest the stomach itself? Why don't I have a hole in my belly?
That is a great question. And it's the third component of the gastric juices.
Mucus.
Mucus.
Yes. We usually think of mucus as a gross thing in our nose, but in the stomach, it's a lifesaver. It coats the inner lining of the stomach wall. It's a shield.
A shield against its own acid.
Right. Without that mucus layer, the acid would absolutely eat through the lining, causing ulcers. So it's a constant battle between the acid trying to burn everything and the mucus holding the line.
It's a very delicate balance.
Okay, so the stomach churns everything into a soup, then it passes it to the small intestine, and the notes call this the site of complete digestion.
This is the main event. This is where the body finally pulls value out of the food. And the design here is brilliant. If you look at the notes, there's a section on villi.
Yeah, they look like little fingers sticking out of the intestine wall, like a shag carpet.
A shag carpet is a perfect visual. Think about it. Why not just have a smooth tube?
I assume it's about space.
It's about surface area. If the intestine were smooth, the food would just slide right past. By having millions of these little fingers, or villi, you increase the surface area massively. That allows the blood vessels inside the villi to absorb as many nutrients as possible.
Now, speaking of the small intestine, there was a comparison in the notes that really stuck with me. The difference between herbivores and carnivores.
Oh, the gut length comparison. This is classic evolutionary biology.
The notes say herbivores, like cows or deer, have a much longer small intestine than carnivores like tigers. That seems counterintuitive. I would have thought digesting a steak takes more work than digesting grass.
You would think so, but it's the opposite. Grass contains cellulose, and cellulose is tough, fibrous stuff. It's incredibly difficult to break down.
So they need a longer factory line.
Exactly. They need more time and space for the cellulose to be digested. Meat, on the other hand, is actually quite easy for enzymes to break apart. So tigers, and to an extent humans, have shorter intestines. We don't need the extra mileage.
That makes sense. Before we leave nutrition, we have to talk about the helpers, the liver and the pancreas. The food doesn't go through them, but they dump stuff in.
Right. They are the chemical suppliers.
The liver makes bile, and the notes make a really specific point here. It says bile has no enzymes. If it has no enzymes, what is it actually doing?
It's doing the dishes.
The dishes.
Think about a greasy frying pan. If you just pour water on it, the grease stays in big globs, right? Water and oil don't mix. But if you add dish soap, the grease breaks apart into tiny little droplets.
Emulsification.
Correct. Bile is biological dish soap. It breaks large fat globules into tiny ones. It doesn't digest them, but it makes them small enough for the actual enzymes to attack them.
And those enzymes come from the pancreas.
Yes. The pancreas is the powerhouse here. It sends in trypsin for proteins and lipase for those now tiny fats.
So we've chewed, churned, acid washed, emulsified, and absorbed. We have glucose. We have the fuel.
But fuel sitting in a tank doesn't make the car go. You have to burn it. And that brings us to pillar two, respiration.
And this is where language gets tricky, because when I say respiration, I just think of breathing in and out.
That's a common confusion. Breathing is just the ventilation getting gas in and out of the lungs. Cellular respiration is the chemical event where we, you know, explode the glucose to get energy.
And the currency of that energy is ATP.
Adenosine triphosphate, the battery of life.
The notes lay out three different ways this glucose breakdown can happen. I call them the good, the bad, and the boozy.
I like that. Let's hear the breakdown.
Okay. The good is what happens normally, right? Aerobic respiration, we have oxygen.
Right. This happens in the mitochondria. Glucose is broken down using oxygen. The waste products are CO2 and water, which are easy to get rid of. And the payout, massive, 38 ATP molecules.
38. That's a full charge. But then there's the boozy, yeast.
Anaerobic respiration. Yeast doesn't need oxygen. It breaks glucose down into ethanol, alcohol, and CO2.
And gives us bread and beer.
And only 2 ATP. It's not efficient at all, but it works for them.
But then there's the third path, the one that happens inside us when things go wrong. The notes talk about lack of oxygen in muscle cells.
This is the one you feel. Have you ever been running, maybe sprinting for a train, and suddenly your legs just start screaming, they cramp up?
Oh yeah, it feels like a knot being tied in the muscle.
That is a supply chain failure. You're demanding energy faster than your lungs can provide oxygen. Your mitochondria are screaming, we need O2, but it's not arriving.
So they shut down?
No, they panic switch to a backup generator. They start breaking down glucose without oxygen.
Anaerobically?
Yes. But just like the yeast, this method is terribly inefficient. You only get 2 ATP instead of 38. But the real problem is the exhaust fumes. Instead of clean water, this process produces lactic acid.
The burn.
That is the burn. Lactic acid accumulates in the muscle tissue, causing cramps. It's your body's way of forcing you to stop so it can catch up on oxygen.
So to avoid the cramp, we need oxygen, which means we need a delivery system, the respiratory system, nostrils, throat, trachea, and finally the lungs.
Specifically the alveoli.
These are the little balloon-like sacs at the end.
Yes. And again, notice the pattern. Just like the villi in the stomach, the alveoli are all about surface area. The notes say they provide a massive surface for gases to exchange.
But here's a question the notes raise that I hadn't thought about. Once the oxygen is in the lungs, why do we need blood? Why can't the oxygen just float through my body to my toes?
Diffusion.
Yeah.
Because you're too big. Diffusion is slow. It works for a bacteria, but for a human. The notes mention that if we relied on diffusion alone, it would take something like 3 years for a molecule of oxygen to travel from your lungs to your toes.
3 years. So my toes would rot off.
Long before the oxygen arrived. So we need a truck. We need a transport vehicle.
Hemoglobin.
Hemoglobin. It's the respiratory pigment in your red blood cells. It grabs oxygen with high affinity and just rushes it through the highways of your body.
Speaking of highways, that leads us right into pillar three.
Yeah.
Transportation. We have the fuel, nutrition. We have the oxidizer, respiration. Now we need logistics.
The circulatory system, the heart and the vessels.
Let's talk about the heart first.
Yeah.
The notes emphasize that our heart is a double pump, right side and left side. Separated by a wall called the septum. Why the wall? Why not just one big mixing pot?
Think about what we just said about energy. You are a warm-blooded mammal. You maintain a constant body temperature. That is an expensive luxury. It burns a lot of ATP.
So I have high energy demands.
Huge. And to meet those demands, you need high-efficiency fuel. You need pure oxygenated blood hitting your cells. If you didn't have that septum wall, the oxygen-rich blood from the lungs would mix with the oxygen-poor blood coming back from the body.
It would be like watering down the gas in your car.
Exactly. You'd be running on diluted fuel. For a lizard sitting on a sun-warmed rock, that's fine. They're cold-blooded. They don't need much energy. But for you, you'd collapse. You need that separation to sustain your metabolism.
That makes the anatomy make so much more sense. It's an efficiency upgrade. Now, what about the pipes? We have arteries and veins.
And they are designed differently because their jobs are different. Arteries carry blood away from the heart.
And the heart is a powerful pump.
Right. So the blood shoots out under high pressure. That's why arteries have thick elastic walls. They need to handle the surge.
Whereas veins are bringing blood back to the heart.
By the time blood hits the veins, the pressure is low. It's a slow river, so the walls are thinner. But veins have a different problem, gravity. If you're standing up, how does blood get from your feet back to your chest?
It's an uphill climb.
It is. So veins have valves, little one-way gates inside the vessel. Blood can go up, but if it tries to fall back down, the valve snaps shut.
Clever. Now, before we wrap up transport, we have to look at plants again. They don't have hearts. They don't have blood. But they have to move water from roots to leaves, sometimes hundreds of feet up.
The notes distinguish between two transport lines here, xylem and phloem.
Xylem is for water. But if there's no pump, how does the water go up?
Physics. Specifically, suction. The notes call it transpiration pull.
Is that related to evaporation?
Essentially, yes. The plant loses water through those open stomata we talked about. That's transpiration. As a water molecule leaves the leaf, it pulls the next one up to take its place. It creates a vacuum chain all the way down to the roots.
Like sucking on a really long straw.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And the best part, it costs the plant zero energy. It's passive.
But the other line, the phloem's different. That's moving food.
Right. Phloem moves the sugar made in the leaves to the rest of the plant. This is called translocation. And unlike the water straw, this isn't free.
This one costs money.
It costs ATP. The plant has to actively pump the sugar into the phloem tissue. This draws water in, creates pressure, and pushes the food where it needs to go.
So water is a free ride, but shipping food requires a postage fee.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay, we're in the home stretch. Pillar four, excretion. We've eaten, burned, and moved everything around. But every factory produces trash.
And in biology, that trash is usually nitrogenous waste, urea. It's toxic. If it builds up in your blood, you die.
Enter the kidneys. And the notes zoom in on the microscopic unit inside the kidney called the nephron.
The nephron is the filtration plant. And I love the parallel here. Remember the alveoli in the lungs?
The balloons.
The nephron uses the same trick. It's a long winding tube to maximize surface area. But the nephron is smarter than just a filter. It's a recycler. Well, the kidney filters a huge amount of liquid from your blood. If you peed all that out, you dehydrate in minutes. So as the liquid travels down the nephron tube, the body reabsorbs the useful stuff.
It takes back the water and the glucose.
Exactly. It grabs the good stuff and puts it back into the blood, leaving only the concentrated waste urine to go to the bladder.
It's basically dumpster diving.
Right.
Checking the trash one last time and to make sure we didn't throw out anything valuable.
The efficient dumpster diving, yes.
And plants. How do they handle their waste?
They are surprisingly chill about it. Oxygen, which we need, is actually a waste product for them, so they just release it. For solid waste, they store it in old leaves.
And then?
They wait for the leaf to die and fall off.
So falling leaves are just the tree taking out the trash.
Pretty much.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
So we've covered the four pillars: nutrition, respiration, transport, excretion. What really hits me is how fragile the connection is.
It is a domino setup.
There was a section in the notes called LALU problems, which I assume means simple questions, but the implications were huge. It talked about anemia.
Right. Hemoglobin deficiency.
It's just one thing missing. But if you lack hemoglobin, your transportation pillar fails.
Which means oxygen doesn't get to the cells.
Which means respiration. The energy burning can't happen.
Which means you have no energy. You feel weak. The whole system powers down because one truck driver didn't show up to work.
And I want to leave listeners with one final image from the notes that really drove this home for me. It's about houseplants.
The overwatering scenario.
Yeah. I am guilty of this. I see a plant, I water it, a lot, and then it dies. And I always thought, well, I drowned it. But the notes explain what actually happens, and it's kind of dark.
It is chemistry. Roots need to breathe. They need oxygen from the air pockets in the soil to do aerobic respiration, the good pathway.
But when I soak the soil,
you push all the air out, the roots are suffocating. So just like your muscles during a sprint, they panic. They switch to the backup plan, anaerobic respiration.
Pathway number two.
The yeast pathway. They start producing ethanol.
Alcohol.
Yes. By overwatering your plant, you aren't just drowning it. You are forcing it to produce alcohol in its own roots. You are giving it alcohol poisoning until it dies.
That is horrifying. And also a really good lesson in how inputs dictate outputs.
It is. The machinery of life is robust, but it follows very strict rules.
Well, on that note, I'm going to go check on my fern and maybe pour out the extra water.
That's a good idea.
This has been a massive deep dive into the engineering of life. Big thanks to Shohit Nirwan's notes for the roadmap. It's amazing to see how a sandwich becomes a thought.
It never gets old.
Thanks for listening. Take a breath, eat something good, and appreciate the factory running inside you. We'll see you in the next deep dive.